Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Just a quick note that today's episode is going to be a rerun. The next season of the Psychology Podcast will begin later this year. I haven't taken any break in 5 years of doing this podcast, so I thought it was about time to take a step back and think about how I can make this a better experience for you all. Until then, enjoy these episodes from our archives. Kristen is an associate professor of human development and culture in the Educational Psychology Department at the University of Texas at Austin. She is author of The Self-Compassion Scales and the book Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself. Thanks, Kristen, for being on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So your story of how you got interested in self-compassion is interesting. Right at the last year in grad school, you became interested in Buddhism, and kind of this was an outgrowth of your interest in Buddhism. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, actually, it's interesting because the very first night I went to the group to learn really meditation to help with the stress I was feeling, the woman leading the group talked a lot about self-compassion, which I hadn't really been expecting. And lucky for me, because it really changed the course of my life that one evening. So it made immediate sense to me. And I started being kinder and more supportive to myself. And I saw the impact almost immediately.
Yeah. Is this something that like you've struggled with your life, like most people, kind of having an inner critic that is loud?
Yeah, it's funny. I wouldn't say I'm a particularly harsh, have a really harsh inner critic. It's kind of like an averagely harsh inner critic. Most people are pretty unkind to themselves. What really made the difference for me is I didn't realize I could support myself when I need it. I was more used to relying on other people to help get me through. And when those people weren't available, I was kind of, you know, up a creek without a paddle, right? So this really helped me learn that when I was upset or anxious or stressed, but also, of course, if I was feeling shame or bad about myself, that it was a way I could really be friendly, supportive, and accepting the way, you know, in good times, other people would be toward me. But I'd actually just gotten out of a divorce, and my ex was not interested in being a kind, compassionate figure to me. I had to do it myself, you know. The whole thing was really a mess. It was a very messy time in my life, which in hindsight is good because it really inspired me to embrace self-compassion. There's a Buddhist teacher in Scotland who says, the goal of practice is to become a compassionate mess. So really, it's like no matter how screwed up your life is, you can always be a compassionate mess. And if you really see that as your aim, the aim is not perfection. The aim isn't to have all your, you know what together. The aim is just to each moment be kind, compassionate, open-hearted. And really, that's a goal anyone can obtain all the time, really.
Oh, I really love that, a compassionate mess.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but it's true. It's like we give up our striving for perfection, and we give up this idea that we aren't supposed to make mistakes and we aren't supposed to get it wrong. Of course we are. That's what's being human. But what we can do is approach all of it with kindness and acceptance and compassion. And ultimately, having our hearts open, at least for many of us, is what we're really after in life, living an open-hearted life.
I'm really interested in people with learning disabilities and kind of showing their strengths and things of that nature. Your son was diagnosed with autism, is that right?
Yeah. Did you see The Horse Boy ever?
No, but I saw an interview with you. Should I see the film?
Sure. It was on Amazon Prime. You can rent it. Yeah, we took a crazy trip to Mongolia, riding from shaman to shaman on horseback. Believe it or not, it worked. I very much had no choice in that situation except to be open-minded. And we tried everything, including shamanism. It's really horses. My son responded radically well to being on horseback. That's where he learned all his language. So we actually have an equine therapy center now. We run an equine therapy center for other kids. Yeah, but I can tell you self-compassion saved my, you know what, over and over again. I don't know how I would have gotten through. Yeah. At least not through in one piece. I mean, the fact that I managed to get through and I think be stronger from it is largely due to my self-compassion practice.
And I hope you teach him how to have some self-compassion for himself as well, right?
No, I do. I do try. You know, I teach him to put his hand on his heart and to breathe deeply. So. Aww.
Wow. He's
very, very loving, sweet kid, sweetheart.
Okay, what is the relationship between mindfulness and self-compassion? There's a very strong link there, right?
Yeah, well, see, the way I define self-compassion is I define mindfulness as one of the core components, or really a foundational aspect of self-compassion. So from my point of view, you can't really be self-compassionate unless you're being mindful. So, right, to the extent that mindfulness gives us the ability to be with things as they are, even if we don't like things the way they are, but to be with it, to turn toward, especially painful feelings without immediately trying to resist or avoid, we have to be mindful of our suffering in order to have self-compassion. If we're just avoiding it, we aren't thinking about it, we're just resisting it, trying to fix the problem, fix ourselves, we can't really hold the space needed to open our hearts to ourselves. Also, if you have self-compassion without mindfulness, what could happen is you could fall into something that looks like self-compassion, but isn't really. Like, for instance, I'm going to throw compassion at myself to try to make the pain go away, right? I'm going to put my hand on my heart. Hopefully, maybe I won't have to feel pain anymore if I do this, if I soothe and comfort myself. In fact, if you use self-compassion as a way to make the pain go away, if you lose your mindfulness, it stops working. So we say self-compassion, we give ourselves compassion not to feel better, but because we feel bad. So in other words, when we're feeling bad, we fully accept that this is how it is without resistance. And yet we also say, "Aw, what can I do to help?" You know, there's that kind, compassionate response. So mindfulness is necessary for compassion, but compassion, I mean, people have various points of view about this. Certainly, compassion isn't always maybe even relevant. If you're mindful of eating a raisin, for instance, compassion doesn't really come into play. Compassion also includes being kind to the person who is suffering and also recognizing that this is part of the shared human condition. Sometimes if you're mindful of eating a raisin, I mean, these detailed elements of compassion aren't really relevant. Maybe there's probably no suffering and you don't give compassion to the raisin, right? But you give compassion to a person who is suffering while mindfully accepting that suffering is present. There's a sense of care, kindness. You're emotionally moved by the suffering. Poor thing. Kindness, support, encouragement. That's the response of the heart. And then also common humanity is very, very important, remembering that the human experience is one of imperfection. People often forget this, not logically. They know it logically. But irrationally, when they make a mistake or they fail or some big struggle happens in their life, they feel this should not be happening. Very powerful emotional reaction. This should not be happening. Something's wrong because this is happening. This is abnormal. It's as if everyone else in the world is living this perfectly happy, normal life with no problems. And it's just me who's failed. It's just me who said that stupid comment or just me who got that diagnosis. And that sense of should and abnormality is really psychologically destabilizing. It makes us feel cut off and isolated from others. So compassion actually means to suffer with. The term compassion, to suffer with. So when our own suffering, that means we recognize that this is a shared experience. It's not just us. And that actually allows any moment of suffering, when held with self-compassion, to be a moment of connection to others. Very, very important for kind of stabilizing us and allowing us to feel, more loving and connected toward everyone, not just ourselves.
It's so obvious that you are very passionate about your research.
Yes. Well, it's really a way of life. I mean, I guess I'm the classic example of a scientist practitioner. You know, I practice self-compassion in my personal life. I teach people self-compassion. I spend a large part of my time teaching people self-compassion. I've developed a curriculum with my colleague Chris Germer to teach self-compassion. So the science for me supplements that. But, you know, sometimes I admit I'm not the total pure scientist because I really study self-compassion to prove what I already know, which maybe is not the most objective stance. But nonetheless, you know, I know it works. I've seen it work. I've felt it work. So for me, the science is a way of trying to understand how it works and, of course, give support for it.
You do good science.
Oh, thank you. No, I mean, it's not like when I say that, I'm kind of joking now. Hopefully, I don't let my biases get involved in the science. But, you know, I kind of like to be upfront about it because I am passionate about it and I do believe in it. And I'm not pretending to be neutral. I think if other people want to show the problems of self-compassion, they're welcome to. I believe in the scientific method, but I've seen so many people whose lives have radically transformed when they started being more self-compassionate to themselves. I know it's a really powerful tool that anyone can learn to help change their lives for the better.
Yeah, I'd like to take your 8-week course.
Yeah, well, we just started teacher training. So we've trained about 600 teachers. It's still growing, though. Like, compared to mindfulness-based stress reduction, we're tiny.
But can I be trained?
You can. You have to take the course first, but yeah. So you can take the course either in your local community as an 8-week course. We also offer the whole 8-week course and a 5-day intensive. You can find it all on the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion website. But yeah, it's really taking off like wildfire. And a lot of teachers teach both mindfulness-based stress reduction and our self-compassion program because they really complement each other. You know, we can kind of talk about explicitly what mindfulness-based stress reduction kind of talks about implicitly. Self-compassion is there, but it's more implicit. Yeah. We really, really explicitly teach the skill. And again, we teach a little bit of mindfulness, but we can't go deeply into it the way it is. So a lot of people are actually saying that taking both programs is very useful. I think so.
Wonderful. What is the difference between self-esteem and compassion? There is a difference.
Here's the difference. Yeah. So when I first introduced the idea of self-compassion into the field, I say introduced the idea, I mean, other people like Carl Rogers had talked about self-acceptance. It wasn't like I came up with the idea, but I kind of was the first to operationally define and measure it. But so I really positioned it as an alternative to self-esteem because I was actually coming off a 2-year postdoc working with a self-esteem researcher and becoming very familiar with all the problems with self-esteem. Not that there are problems with having self-esteem, but there are problems with trying to get it, right? We know very clearly that, for instance, the reason kids start to bully other kids is because they want to feel good about themselves. It's an attempt to get high self-esteem. The reason people are prejudiced, self-esteem is very contingent. We have it one moment and then we fail and it deserts us. So I was studying all this in my postdoc and I was practicing self-compassion in my personal life. And I realized that really what self-compassion does, and the evidence supports this, it offers all the same mental health benefits of self-esteem, right? With self-esteem, great in terms of less anxiety, less depression, more happiness. Same with self-compassion, but it's not contingent the way self-esteem is. In other words, when we fail, that's precisely when self-compassion steps in, exactly when self-esteem deserts us. And it's not based on feeling better than others. It's, all you got to do is be your average compassionate mess like everyone else. You don't have to be, you know, special and above average. And it's not linked to narcissism the way self-esteem is. So, yeah, it seems to be really offering the benefits of self-esteem. It's kind of like a type of unconditional self-esteem. So researchers have talked about unconditional self-esteem, and it's like, well, that's great, but how do I get it? Well, this is one way to get it.
I love that. It's like you're married to yourself for better or worse, and sickness or health.
Yeah. So it's like, do you want to be an inner enemy or an inner ally? That's really the choice we all face. And most of us walk around with an inner enemy inside our own heads, cutting us down, undermining us, pulling the rug out from underneath us. And when we switch that relationship and start being an inner supportive friend, we are much stronger, more capable of dealing with adversity. Some people think self-compassion is weak. Is it weak to have an inner ally as opposed to an inner enemy? No, it's an amazing strength. But people really are afraid that self-compassion means being weak. In fact, they do. People have this reaction like, oh, self-compassion, I'm going to be soft and weak and wimpy. But I think people haven't really thought about it deeply, right? So the idea of being kind is seen as weakness, whereas being harsh is seen as strength. But in fact, internally, if we're harsh with ourselves, if we cut ourselves down, we are weakening ourselves. We're undermining our self-confidence. Whereas if we're kind, supportive, and encouraging, we're strengthening ourselves. I think people just don't really think it through clearly, and our culture doesn't encourage it. But if you look at the coping literature, like vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, for instance, they find that the level of self-compassion is more predictive of whether or not they'll develop PTSD than level of combat exposure that they face. So it's absolutely a strength. It helps us cope with life's biggest challenges to be an inner friend, an inner support, and an inner ally when we need it most. Sorry.
I love it. No, I love it. I love it.
Red, self-compassion.
Just wanted to take this moment to thank you all for your support of the podcast over the years. It's been a real privilege to do this podcast for y'all. It's been a real labor of love. If you'd like to further support the podcast, I wanted to let you know a few things you could do to help make it a better experience for you all. First, I'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. This would help make the show more prominent on iTunes and increase our listenership. I believe you can subscribe both on your iPhone and on your computer. Second, it'd be great if you could give the show a rating and review in iTunes. I definitely read all the reviews, and they're helpful to others who are thinking about giving the show a listen. Another thing you can do is donate something to the show. Even just the price of a cup of coffee would really help me continue to do this podcast for you all. To donate something, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com and click on the link at the bottom that says Become a Sponsor. So thanks again for your incredible support of the show over the years. You know, I do this show for you all because I truly love sharing my enthusiasm and love of the mind, brain, and creativity, and I really appreciate you joining me on this journey. Okay, now back to the show.
By the way, if you were your age you are now in the 60s, you would be even more popular, I think.
Well, I don't know, because, you know, what's beautiful now that wasn't possible in the 60s is there's a whole field of people who are mixing kind of personal practice, Buddhism, typically meditation, with science, rigorous science. In the 60s, it was a little more hippy-dippy, you know, and my hippie name is Blossom Free Flower, and I definitely had my part of my hippie childhood. So a lot of these ideas to me, yeah.
Who named you that? Who named you that?
My father. Oh, it wasn't my official name, but yeah. So definitely spent some time in the hippie world. The thing about it is there's an element to it that was kind of flaky. I mean, some real genuine good spirituality. I grew up with Ram Dass's Be Here Now coffee book on my table. I think it's a brilliant book, Be Here Now. It's really a mindfulness book before its time. But because there was a lot of lack of credibility, we got mixed up in a lot of personality cults and things went haywire and things weren't done responsibly, I think. Whereas now with this approach, meditation combined with science, I feel like we've got the good of that spiritual movement, but without the, I don't know, flakiness is the only word I could think of, with more rigor, more reality, more our feet more firmly planted on the ground in a way that's very useful. So I'm not in the 60s.
I take it back. You've convinced me. You're your perfect time period to do
perfect
the work
time.
You're doing.
I mean, well, yeah, and really, you know, my work rides on the coattails very closely of the mindfulness movement. If it wasn't people like Jon Kabat-Zinn and Richie Davidson and all these people doing rigorous scientific research on mindfulness, my work wouldn't have been as readily accepted. So I definitely came at the right time in terms of other people had done the work for me so I could kind of slot myself in. But
absolutely. Yeah. I agree. And you developed a scale, a 26 item long, that's the longest version of the scale. And then you have a shorter version. And it measures different aspects like self-kindness, self-judgment, common humanity, isolation, mindfulness, over-identified.
Yes, the various components. It measures both compassionate and uncompassionate behavior. The scale, because it was kind of the only game in town, has come under criticism lately about its psychometric validity across populations. I just published a new article that uses a new form. It's probably not relevant to your readers, but basically really establishes the validity of the self-compassion scale using a new form of analysis. So, but this is good. It kind of, I just collected a large data set, 5 different samples using a new type of analysis that really shows, from my point of view, I'm happy with the scale. I think it stands up.
Great. Because you've done, there's so many studies that have been done with this scale.
Yeah, hundreds, yeah.
And I just want to just review some of the major findings. Like really almost like every aspect of life, human life, you found a correlation.
It's almost nothing that it doesn't help.
Nothing. I can't find anything.
Probably not with cooking skill or, you know, but yeah, it's a, there's only been one published study that shows that it might not be such a good thing for men only who are low in conscientiousness in the context of romantic relationships. It's like a very, and I think what's happening is men who are low in conscientiousness, usually self-compassion goes with more conscientiousness. You got this weird subpopulation. I think what happens, they found that men who were low in conscientiousness, if you told them to be more self-compassionate, they actually used it as a way to evade taking responsibility in their which I see is they were kind of not really opening clearly their heart to themselves. They were just using it. You can misuse anything if you're clever enough. So that's kind of what I see what was happening. But pretty much, yeah, either it seems to be linked to pretty much all good things psychological. But if you think it's such a deep process, again, being an inner friend rather than an inner enemy, as opposed to an inner enemy, there's almost nothing that that's not going to help.
But I was wondering, can you be really high in self-compassion and really low in compassion for others. What if you're like high in self-compassion, but you're low in agreeableness on the big five? What's going on there?
In terms of compassion for others, it almost never happens. I want to play with some data. I haven't figured out how I can do the analysis. But we created a compassion for others scale using the same components, very structurally similar, including the same endpoint. So you can kind of look at, you know, how often you're compassionate versus self-compassionate. Almost everybody is more compassionate to others than themselves, significantly more so. As a matter of fact, among college undergraduates, they aren't even significantly related. The way people treat themselves and others is radically different. In almost every single case, people are more compassionate to others than to themselves. I think like 2% of people, but I'm not sure if I'm doing the analysis right, but it seemed like 2% of people were significantly more compassionate to themselves than others. So I don't know what's going on with those 2%, but it's very, very tiny, right? So people are much harder on themselves than others. And I think there's reasons for that. But it doesn't happen very often that you're compassionate to self but not to others.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think it's important that you distinguish self-compassion from narcissism. And it's very clear that there are different things.
Yeah. Now, you might say I'm being self-compassionate, which is why I don't care about you, and which is why I'm going to blow off seeing my kids and move to Hawaii or something, you know, whatever. That's not really self-compassion. So I think if it's true self-compassion, which is probably why it needs the mindfulness, because mindfulness is where the clear seeing is, and just like looking things straight in the face and saying, yep, I own that. I did that. Or this is my responsibility. The mindfulness helps ground us and see clearly. And then the kindness is the warm-hearted response to that. And the common humanity is recognizing that it's not just me, this stuff everyone faces. But you need all three components, otherwise it could morph into self-pity or narcissism or self-indulgence.
Oh, what are the three components? Tell me what the three
components are. Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, so the three components, and each one kind of has a positive, compassionate versus uncompassionate aspect. So the first is being kind, supportive, and caring to yourself, treating yourself like you would treat a good friend, as opposed to being harshly self-critical and judgmental, which is the way actually most of us are with ourselves. The second component involves seeing our imperfection and suffering as part of the shared human condition. This is normal. It's normal to make mistakes. It's normal to fail. It's normal to have struggles, as opposed to feeling isolated in that, as if somehow everyone else was leading a normal, perfect life and it's just me who's failed or who's struggling. And then the third component is the mindfulness, right? Being able to be aware when we're suffering and see it in a kind of balanced, stable manner, a clear-sighted manner, as opposed to what I call over-identification. And that's really a process where we run away with the dramatic storyline of, oh, this is so terrible. It's the worst thing that ever happened. You know, this is bad and therefore I am bad. So that kind of emotional dysregulation really would be the opposite of mindfulness. So I call it three components, but if you consider both the positive and the negative aspect, it's really six.
Oh, cool. Okay, so you need all those components.
You need all those components because if not, it can morph. Like they say in Buddhism that pity is the near enemy of compassion. So if you were just being kind to yourself, but it had the quality of kind of feeling sorry for yourself, if you weren't remembering that, hey, this is everyone suffers, and if you were, you know, getting lost in an exaggerated storyline of how bad things are, if you weren't seeing things clearly, self-compassion could easily turn into self-pity. We need the mindfulness and the common humanity to keep it from being self-pity and to keep it just being the stable, clear-sighted, open-hearted way of relating to yourself.
Are there some people that really shouldn't be self-compassionate? Like, do you think Donald Trump, like, could use more self-compassion?
I don't know what's going on with Donald Trump. I think that's one area that we need to look at more closely. And I'm not a clinical psychologist, but some people have asked me, should you teach narcissists self-compassion? And I actually don't know the answer to that. I also know there are different types of narcissism, and sometimes narcissism is stemming from underlying self-hate. And in that case, it may be a good thing. If not, I'm not sure. At this point, I don't think we can clearly say that there's anyone who wouldn't benefit from self-compassion. Certainly some people have a more difficult time with it. People, for instance, who've got with a trauma background, early childhood history of, you know, neglect or abuse. It can be scary, actually, to be self-compassionate because those feelings of warmth and care that we hopefully normally got from a caring caregiver if it gets mixed up with other feelings like fear or neglect, then it can actually activating that whole self-soothing system can actually be a little frightening. Paul Gilbert calls it fear of compassion. So although it is harder for some people and some people have to go slower, I recommend that some people, when they go down the self-compassion path, they do it with the help of a therapist because, you know, really most of us have closed our hearts in response to suffering most of our lives. And when we start opening our hearts, there's a term we use for it in our program called backdraft. Like you let in the fresh oxygen of compassion and the pain comes rushing out. And sometimes it's like a boom. Sometimes it's more mild, but this is normal. But sometimes it does help to have a little support as you're going down the path of self-compassion in case you get overwhelmed by the pain that you actually touch. But pretty much anyone so far that we've seen can learn self-compassion. You just may have to let yourself be a slow learner is all. But people, for instance, with trauma histories who learn to be more self-compassionate, it's one of the most effective ways of coping with one's past and moving on from it by giving yourself what maybe you didn't get from, you know, your early childhood. So, yeah, and the thing is, it's not rocket science. I think that's the thing that surprised me, that I thought it might be harder for people who are really, you know, habitual self-critics to learn these new ways. The thing is, most people have a fair amount of experience being compassionate to those they care about, you know, friends, family members. They know what to say. They know how, the tone of the voice to use. They kind of have a lot of experience being a caring, compassionate friend to another. So all you have to really do is, A, give yourself permission to relate to yourself that way and to remember. But if you just ask people, okay, the way you spoke to yourself right now, would you say that to someone you really cared about? No, I probably wouldn't. What would you say to someone you cared about? And then you get them to do that, and then they kind of have this tool already.
Let me ask you something I've been thinking about. Shouldn't you be hard on yourself sometimes?
Well, so self-compassion means you don't see yourself clearly. And in fact, one of the most useful aspects of self-compassion is it allows us to hold our shame. Sometimes we feel shame for a very good reason. We've done something really harmful. And self-compassion gives us the strength to own it. In fact, people who are more self-compassionate take more responsibility than others for the harm they've caused because they have the strength. Wow. So self-compassion, it doesn't mean you condone bad behavior. In fact, just the opposite. What it's saying is it's allowing that I am imperfect. And yes, in an ideal world, I would have not made that mistake. Absolutely. But, you know, it also acknowledges the truth that we aren't in total control, right? We do the best we can, but we didn't choose our genes, how reactive our wiring is.
But what if you didn't do the best you can? What if, like, you intentionally did something bad?
Well, so, okay, this is an interesting, let me start getting the philosophy here, right?
Yeah.
What is it that made you choose that action in the moment? Most likely, that choice was contingent upon thousands of causes and conditions that you actually didn't choose, right? So this is kind of a philosophical position. And, you know, I kind of take the more Buddhist view that we are in part of a larger interdependent whole, and there's no separate self that is capable of radical choice independent of all other causes and conditions. So really the wisdom of self-compassion is saying, hey, this is what I was capable of doing at the time. Does that mean I am a bad person? Usually, you know, again, we do think self-compassion is positively linked to guilt, which is I did something bad. It's negatively linked to shame, which is, and therefore I am bad. And this is where the common humanity comes in, understanding the complexity. Self-compassion sees very clearly, I made a mistake. I did wrong. I'm really going to try to commit as much as I can not to doing it again. But it doesn't say, and therefore, I am a hopeless, worthless, and you know, start calling yourself names, which actually that type of behavior is usually what keeps people from taking responsibility in the first place. They don't want to admit that, yeah, I'm a horrible person. No, I'm not. It must be your fault, you know? So, but yeah, some of it is kind of your philosophical approach. Do I think self-compassion has to be earned? I think all human beings, by their very nature, we're all born into this world as innocent babies. You know, we don't have a lot of control. We certainly didn't choose our genes. We don't have a lot of control about how we're raised, the influences that condition our habitual patterns. And therefore, I think all people are intrinsically worthy of compassion. But that doesn't mean we condone behavior. Paul Gilbert has a great phrase for this. He says, it's not your fault but it is your responsibility.
Well, a lot of existential philosophers talked about that as well.
Yeah, so, and I think that's a view of self-compassion. And again, the empirical support seems to show if you help people, like a study by Greens and Chen out of Berkeley, they had people think about something they had done to hurt someone they felt really bad about. And half the people, they helped them by thinking about the three components of self-compassion in relation to what they did. I think they had a self-esteem control group and a neutral writing control group. People who were helped to be self-compassionate about what they did were more likely to take responsibility, to own it. Wow, I really messed up. Were more motivated to try to repair the harm.
I like that. I really like that. It sounds like you're a very compassionate person yourself.
Well, you know, it's a way of life. I certainly walk my walk. Not that I'm always perfectly compassionate to everyone.
That's your whole point. Yeah.
The nice thing about practicing self-compassion is you don't claim, I don't claim to be mindful all the time or never to be reactive or never be out of line, but I'm pretty quick always to come to a place of self-compassion. Because what choice do we have? I mean, if it's a choice between being self-compassionate mess or being perfect, good luck with the perfection. That's what most of us try to be. Okay, I just will never make a mistake. I will be perfect. And I just try really, really hard to be perfect. You know, good luck. It's just not reality.
Have you found a link to reduced levels of perfectionism?
Yeah. So basically, you know, if you look at, there's two-part way of measuring perfectionism. One is how high you strive, your standards, the goals you set for yourself. The other is how you treat yourself when you don't meet your goals. And so self-compassion is unrelated to how your standards, or how you know, the aims you adopt for yourself or the goals you set for yourself. But it's very negatively linked to how much you beat yourself up when you don't meet your standards.
Good,
so it's negatively linked to what they call maladaptive perfectionism. There's nothing wrong with aiming high. You know, it's just that if you aim high and you fail and you beat yourself up, you can become afraid of failure. And you're going to stop trying. So all that doesn't happen with self-compassion.
Yeah. And that links to your earlier point that conscientiousness is positively correlated with.
It is. Yeah. And motivation. A lot of people think that self-compassion is going to undermine motivation. The data shows just the opposite. Right? So again, fear of failure, performance anxiety, undermining your self-confidence, all of these are associated with self-criticism. That's going to undermine your motivation. But being a support, like kind of think of that encouraging, kind, supportive coach who may give you criticism, but it's going to be constructive criticism as opposed to harsh, belittling criticism. That type of support is much more effective for motivating ourselves than our usual pattern, which is just to say, I'm a hopeless loser. I'm ashamed of myself. You know, how good a motivator is that?
I don't think Trump ever says that to himself.
He doesn't, no. So, yeah.
I want to wrap up just for the listeners, some like amazing findings. You know, you found that self-compassion is linked to less anxiety, depression. It's linked to a lack of self-criticism, less rumination, lower levels of stress, as well as the stress hormone cortisol, higher levels of well-being, a higher motivation to learn and grow, like a mastery mindset. Found self-compassion was found to help people after divorce cope with divorce, cope with early childhood traumas, cope with chronic physical pain. It's important for relationships. Yeah.
It's not selfish. It actually improves relationships. Very important point.
Wow. Yeah. Great point. And there's also cultural differences in self-compassion. Is that right? Is our country, are we like low in self-compassion?
Yeah, you know, I wish more people would do research on this. I did a study with two of my grad students like in 2005. Almost nothing has been done, which is kind of annoying because I don't have time to do everything. But I had a student from Thailand and a student from Taiwan. And the idea is, you know, it's not like a simple east-west difference. In Thailand, people were most self-compassionate. It's more infused in the culture. Buddhism is a big part of the culture. Like, for instance, most men, they go on a week silent meditation week before they get married. They take it seriously. Taiwan is more Confucian, and they use self-criticism as a way to motivate themselves. So we found that highest levels were in Thailand, lowest levels were in Taiwan, and the United States was in between. But interestingly, in all three cultures, we've got the same strong positive association between self-compassion and well-being. But even if you're in a culture that doesn't promote self-compassion, you're still going to personally benefit by having more rather than less of it.
Still helps. Well, that's just wonderful. That's a great place to end, I think, because okay. It shows that anyone, except maybe narcissists, can benefit. Thank you so much for your generosity today.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next season for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.